Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 276. What are recent advances in the field of quantum computing and high-performance computing? What Python tools can you use to develop programs that run on a quantum computer? This week on the show, Real Python author Nigar Vahid discusses her tutorial, Quantum Computing Basics with Qiskit. Nigar digs into the fundamentals of quantum computers, describing qubits, superposition, entanglement, and interference. We discuss the concept of quantum advantage and the fields of exploration where quantum computing promises speedups over classical computers. She also shares tools for designing quantum circuits with Python. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Nigar. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. You've been making a few different things for Real Python for a while. You've done a couple video courses for us, and I don't know, is this your first article for us?
This is my second article. The first one was about Torch Audio, yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, this one is diving into the world of quantum computing, which is something I know very little about. I've been trying to research in the background, so I have a bunch of questions that we'll get into today. And there is a Python component, but I think this is also kind of a fun exploration into not only quantum computing, but also the world of HPC or high performance computing, which I think is funny because I always thought of it as supercomputing, but maybe we've changed the name.
Yeah, it's like a more general term for, you know, parallel computing and supercomputers. So it's like a umbrella term.
Okay.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I guess there are a variety of types of them now and ways that they become more and higher performance.
Yeah, exactly. A bunch of different tools, yeah.
So what I'd like to start with, and this will probably lead into your background a bit, but what drew you to quantum computing? Why are you interested in this field?
Yeah, it was actually by pure chance because I was working on something completely different. I was working on neuromorphic computing, which is a whole different thing, which is mimicking the brain and creating algorithms based on that.
Going beyond the neural network to even more stuff?
Exactly. Basically, like making the neural networks perform more like how the brain works.
Okay.
And yeah, but then it wasn't really clicking for me because I was, you know, I was doing computer science as my graduate studies and it's very, very interesting. But then I was like, do I want to do this for the next 7 years? And I started kind of looking through, you know, emerging topics and I came across quantum computing and I was like, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. and I took this introductory boot camp summer of 2023. And I just fell in love. I was like, oh, this makes no sense. I love it.
I think we'll get into that a little bit today. Yeah, it's kind of funny. The topics and the concepts and the quotes that you even have in the article are all kind of funny because it's a very interesting field that it's very, very hard to define, very, very hard to even somewhat visualize in some ways. So I hope we'll break down some of that and provide some other resources as we go.
Yeah, it is completely counterintuitive, and I love that about it, yeah.
So where are you in your, I guess, university journey? Like, how long are you, and what are you looking to get? Are you going for, like, a PhD?
Yeah, so I'm finishing up my master's degree right now in computational science and engineering, and yeah, I would like to get my PhD ASAP after that, yeah.
So there's been some interesting announcements also that I think are kind of timely. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Google's, I feel like these companies have all these different events throughout the year, and so I get the names wrong. I don't think it was I.O., or was that the name of the event? But they had an announcement of, hey, we've achieved something here. The term is quantum advantage, and I was like, what does that even mean? And maybe we can kind of use that as a background and provide a link to some videos here. Do you want to describe that? What is quantum advantage?
Yeah. Well, quantum advantage is when a quantum computer performs better than a classical computer. And this could mean like it's more cost effective, it's more accurate, or it's just faster. So it could be, you know, any of that.
Okay.
And well, so far we haven't really seen, you know, a verified algorithm that everyone is like, yes, this is quantum advantage. There, okay. I mean, you mentioned Google. Yeah, Google announced quantum echoes, which is a claim for verifiable quantum advantage or quantum supremacy. But it's still, you know, there's a question mark there still. So it's not like a for sure thing, but it is definitely, yeah, it's a step for sure.
So there needs to be additional verification, other people trying the things out to, because it's a bunch of competing forces and a bunch of sort of universities, but a lot of other countries are trying to do the same thing. And that's where I thought the advantage was, like, but that was, I was thinking wrong there. It's a comparison to what we would call classical computing.
Yeah, so classical computing is kind of like a fancy word for basically what we use now. So bits, you know, we have our cell phones, we have our laptops. That's just basically called classical computing.
Okay. Is this big news in the quantum computing world, or is it, like you said, still something where it needs to be verified for it to like be like a thing where you'll see it everywhere?
Well, it is a huge step, but researchers and scientists are very diligent when it comes to just announcing quantum advantage is for sure, you know, realized. So yeah, but currently they did claim that it is a verifiable algorithm, meaning like, you know, you could do it again and you would get the same result and same advantage. But it's sort of tricky because before Google had announced another claim to quantum advantage, but then it wasn't verifiable. So it was random sampled, so you couldn't like run it again. So that's why people are a little bit skeptic to this announcement.
Okay.
But so far it's held up. Yeah.
I guess that might be our lead in to, okay, well, your article is named Quantum Computing Basics with Qiskit. Is that the, I'm pronouncing it right?
Yes. Okay. Qiskit. Yeah.
It starts with a Q. Did you find it difficult in writing this article to think about how to explain quantum computing? Like, were there things you had to think about, like, how do I break this down? Or is that something that is pretty standard? Like in your boot camp, were there like very, very standard ways of explaining these topics?
Actually, it was very difficult for me because when I started learning about quantum computing, I was very scared because it's very intimidating to look at textbooks and even blog posts are filled with mathematical notations and they'd require a deep knowledge of quantum mechanics, which, well, it is necessary. I mean, eventually, if you want to, you know, be a pro, but to understand at first, I believe it's just kind of intimidating and makes people just not want to learn quantum computing. So it's kind of being gatekept behind all this mathematics.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I was writing the article, I didn't have any reference to just explaining the information, but also stay technical, but not include mathematics. So it was kind of a struggle, but I hope it turned out well.
Yeah, I enjoyed the beginning of it, not having much of a background in it, and hearing the terms and hearing what a qubit is and hearing the idea of state and entanglement. And these are like almost like things that I see that have been torn off and used in science fiction in that sort of realm. But I kind of stopped math at a certain point, which is a bummer because I was really enjoying math, but I ended up with a kind of a weird scandal happened at my high school, which is really a dumb thing. But the math teacher was basically taken away. And so my physics teacher became my math teacher. And this is during like calculus.
Oh.
And she was a terrible math teacher. She was still figuring that out, but she was an amazing physics teacher. So it kind of bummed me out on the whole thing. And university was not a great place for me to learn mathematics at the time. So I feel like that's where I kind of stopped. And so when I saw your resources at the end of the article, I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe if I am interested in getting into some of this, like, you reference linear algebra and a resource from Khan Academy. Do you think that's a good starting point?
Absolutely. If you want to understand the math behind quantum computing, it's all matrices. So you would need to understand how to deal with them, how to multiply them, how to add them together. That's where you start. Yeah. So I highly recommend linear algebra.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because it's come up so many times on the show because that there's so many of our tools in Python, but also data science that allow you to do a lot of that. NumPy in and of itself, allowing you to do a lot of that. And it's kind of come up a few different times.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Even in my HPC course that I'm taking in my graduate school, everything we deal with is just matrices and how difficult they are to handle. So absolutely, it's a thing that comes up a lot.
So if you will, maybe we could start with some fundamentals here about what makes up a quantum computer. And maybe we can start with what are sort of the fundamental building blocks of it. You actually go into a variety of styles in the hardware realm and the sort of the physics realm. But maybe we can start with just sort of like conceptually, what are you trying to create with that?
Absolutely. So quantum computers are specialized hardware that make quantum computing possible.
Okay.
And quantum computing is basically a new paradigm of computing, which has some weird properties that allow us to gain advantage over just using classical computing.
Okay. One of the advantages you point out is this sort of massive parallel processing. This idea that we talk a lot about parallel processing in Python lately because we were, you know, thinking about the GIL, and we're thinking about ways that we could have five or six different ways to have concurrency going. But this is not looking at it in the classical sense where you're building threads, you're looking at asynchronous kind of stuff. You're looking at like literally processing across like a mass amount of stuff. Am I explaining that right?
Sort of. Actually, I'm so glad that you use parallel computing here because it's fundamentally different, actually, quantum computing.
Okay.
So in parallel computing, you have a bunch of data and you're just basically processing them in parallel. But then in quantum computing, you have probabilities of the states. They're not the states themselves, but say you want to reach like a certain desired state, okay, or a desired result. And what quantum computing does is that it cancels out the probability of getting that result wrong and it amplifies the correct result. So it's the probability of them. It's not like the states themselves, which is, again, it's kind of difficult to visualize, but it's just how nature works.
Okay. In that process of creating a quantum computer, I kind of lost track on this stuff. I remember like 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, they were making machines that could have maybe 4 or 8 qubits. Am I right?
Exactly.
Okay. And so there's not a whole lot you can do, but like they're able to create those states of the qubit being somewhere in a superposition between 0 and 1. But the advancements have been to have hundreds. Is that right?
Yes. Currently, we have 133 qubit devices with IBM.
Yeah.
And we're still very, you know, 133 is not a lot. And we probably will need at least 1,000 qubits to be working properly to actually get real advantage, basically.
Yeah. So they're going back to the Google thing to use as an example. Mm-hmm. They were doing sort of a technique where they were disturbing something within that quantum array and then being able to do, they were calling it echolocation, find where that disturbance is within the array, which I thought was kind of an interesting way. Theirs was around 100 qubits, I think also. It seems like everybody's kind of advancing at about the same rate here from a few years ago. And it'll be interesting to see how much it goes because these machines are massive. I don't know if have you seen a quantum computer at this point? Have you visited one in a university?
I have not, but I've seen, pictures. And actually, fun fact about them being very large. So the actual quantum chips are not big. So they're actually small, like the ones that we have in classical computing. The reason that they're big is that they need to stay cool.
Right.
And the devices that actually, you know, keep them cold are the reason that they're so massive.
Is that true across all those different sort of physics situations, like the ones that are commonly used, I think, of IBM and Google that are, again, maybe a little bit more known, are bringing it to a super cooled position? Maybe you can explain it better, but I feel like that's what's happening as far as identifying the qubits there.
So yeah, what you're referring to is called superconducting qubits or devices.
Yeah.
And they are tiny electrical circuits that are cooled close to absolute zero. And they're kept in very big fridges, as I said, and IBM and Google both are using these type of hardware.
Okay. Like all of other computing right now, the idea of keeping it as small as possible in some ways is helping toward, like, all right, we have less to keep cool and we have less wiring and other things that we have to kind of pay attention to there. So I guess that makes sense of keeping it small.
You mean like the number of qubits?
Well, also just the physicalness of it, and then keeping that space or that hardware at the core where it's going to be doing the computing super cooled. If you were going to do, you know, anything larger,
yeah, absolutely,
it's going to require,
yeah, absolutely,
even more.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the same thing that's happening with, you know, our processors today. We've gone from, what, 7 nanometer down to 5 nanometer down to, we're, you know, getting down into atomic levels. And there, I think that's actually something you bring up in the article, though, that there is this limit, right? The Moore's law of computing, that we can only do this doubling of circuits and doubling of computing power to a certain point where we're going to hit sort of limits.
Yeah, exactly. And we're very close to that limit because, first of all, it's very, very difficult to achieve this and very expensive.
Yeah.
And at some point onwards, like, you just basically can't. So you just reach that limit. And this is why quantum computing has become such a hot topic, because we need more power. We need something new.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the newest big story is from multiple years ago of creating specialized graphic processors that can do the matrix math, but kind of in a different way. They're able to do things on a reduced instruction set. So you see these data centers and other things, or potentially even at your home, taking a high-end graphics card. You know, NVIDIA is literally one of the biggest stocks in the world because of what has changed about computing over the several years here. So this is yet another angle that could be used to look at ways to make computers continue to grow in speed and power.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the misconceptions about quantum computing is that it's supposed to replace our normal classical computers, but it isn't actually. It's just an aid for because our classical computers work pretty well. You know, they just need some help. Yeah.
And there's a lot of software already written for them.
Yeah, exactly.
That we're going to continue to do. Yeah. And so as we've rewritten some of the software to run on graphical processor units doing specialty jobs, you kind of think of the same thing. Like, it used to be literally like a sidecar. You'd add this to your computer to do that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm old enough to remember adding a math coprocessor to your, you know, CPU inside your computer that would literally just do math. And then again, the graphics units kind of have evolved in that realm. I don't think anybody will be adding a quantum computer sidecar to their home computer anytime soon. But
yeah, exactly. And I guess we would never actually even need to have a quantum computer integrated in our normal laptops or cell phones, because quantum computing is designed for very specific problems, like especially when we deal with scientific computing, meaning when we want to simulate nature or just designing algorithms for scientific purposes like drug design or material science. So I guess, yeah, that time will never come when we have like a tiny quantum computer just in our home.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be in the home anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's a nice avenue for us to travel down here. What makes it able to do those types of science experiments and those types of programs? Why are quantum computers a better choice for something like that?
That's a great question. We already kind of mentioned qubits. So okay. Qubits, they are basically quantum bits. So they can be 0, 1, and then a combination of the two. And that combination is called superposition. So that actually allows for two more very weird quantum properties called entanglement and interference.
Okay.
So, and just very quickly, I mean, these are very counterintuitive, just, you know, as a as a reminder, but
not
basically,
only are we describing this as audio, you know, any visual
yeah,
aids, but
exactly.
You can look at the article.
You can look at the article, but there's no visualization. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes. So basically, because we have superposition, we can have entanglement, and entanglement is when two qubits are related in a way that, if you even like put them in another planet, like for example, qubit one is on Earth and qubit two is in Jupiter.
Yeah.
If you measure or just look at that qubit and see if it's a zero or a one, then the other one will also reveal in relation to what you see. Like for example, if qubit one is zero, depending on how you designed your program, you're going to know if the other one is zero and one. So basically you measure one, but you get two results. So that already gives us advantage. And also interference. Well, imagine the qubits as waves.
Okay.
And just so like you get interference with waves, you can design your program in a way where the wrong results get canceled out and the right result, like the desired result, gets amplified. So you get to that result faster.
Okay.
So these three things are the main reason that a quantum computer can perform better. Quantum computers can give us results that are either less expensive, faster, or more accurate.
I feel like some of the experiments, like you were talking about, of this idea of a wave, you're sort of, the interference is sort of disturbing this field of qubits. Is that a way to describe it?
Well, it can either be disrupting it or actually amplifying it. So it depends
right.
on, yeah, it depends on the program. Yeah.
Having, you know, I lived in Hawaii for a while, so I spent quite a bit of time at a beach and watching waves themselves and how they counteract and amplify things or potentially take another wave down, you know, and just watching that, I would guess that would be kind of a similar idea here if you could kind of want to make a visualization of it.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Okay, cool. So you could then guide these things potentially. You could kind of direct the waves in a way to, like you said, amplify or create the types of results that you're trying to aim for.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great analogy, yeah.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. Do you want to optimize the performance of your Python program to make it run faster or consume less memory? Well, this course is titled Profiling Performance in Python, and it's based on Real Python Tutorial by Bartosz Jaczynski. And the video course is presented by my guest this week, Nagar Vahid. The course digs into several areas of advice. Before diving into any performance tuning, why you should consider software profiling, determining if the effort to refactor will take longer to improve the code than the amount of times you'll run it, using a profiler to learn where your program consumes memory and ways to make it more efficient, and how to use several Python tools to measure the performance of your code, including TimeIt, cProfile, pStats, and PyInstrument. And as a precursor to checking out the video course, here's a short checklist to figure out whether you need to work on performance. Testing: have you tested your code to prove that it works as expected and without errors? Then refactoring: does your code need some cleanup to become more maintainable and Pythonic? And finally, profiling: have you identified the most inefficient parts of your code? Like most of the video courses on Real Python, the course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, you get code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. So you mentioned drug design.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that was mentioned in the Google event. They discussed it a little bit, this idea of ways that they could look at, I think it was proteins. What were some of the other ones you mentioned? I know that you talked about finance a little bit in the article. Is that something that they're experimenting with currently?
Yeah, actually, the finance results was from IBM and Vanguard.
Okay.
And they use quantum computing for portfolio construction. So that's basically selecting a bunch of assets based on a certain financial goal that you have in mind. And this is notoriously difficult with classical computing. The current algorithm kind of fails to give you the results when you need it. So it's not timely, you could say. So this is a real problem because the assets kind of are correlated, and quantum computers love when the features are correlated. So what they did is they ran quantum algorithm, which is novel, for this problem, and they achieved amazing results. They achieved some sort of utility. You can't really call it quantum advantage because they tried a very small problem, like a simplified problem. But it does show that quantum computers can be used in finance and things that are not inherently quantum, which is a huge step forward.
The entanglement thing is one of those areas where you're like, huh? And the idea of the massive distances, I think of where that would be amazing, again, the science fiction world already using this is in like a version of a communicator, some kind of communication device that could be that sort of distance, you know, without any kind of light or other waveform type of delay, mm-hmm. which would be pretty incredible. I don't know if that's something that has even been looked at. Have you heard about communication being used in this way?
Well, not communication. So far, it hasn't been proved to work. But entanglement itself,
yeah.
It has been proved that it actually doesn't care about the distance.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
You've been talking a little bit about IBM there. What is your relationship working with the tools that IBM is providing?
Yeah, so IBM has this programming module, Python programming module. It's called Qiskit, which I talk about in the tutorial as well. And it's, you could say it's the standard quantum module that everyone uses.
Okay.
And basically, yeah, I've learned most of the things that I know about their YouTube channel. They have a bunch of articles. And actually, recently, I became a Qiskit advocate that is supported by IBM, which is an amazing opportunity to learn more about the functionalities in real life.
Cool.
Yeah, and I highly encourage viewers, in case they're interested, to check out Qiskit Summer School.
Okay.
Which is organized every year. And basically, there are usually 4 or 5 challenges, and they teach you how to use Qiskit with a real problem and run it on their platform.
Maybe break that down a little bit. In the article, you are designing kind of a hello world for quantum computing experiments.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a fairly common question as far as like analyzing, is it a single qubit that sort of starts it? Maybe you can kind of explain it. But what I want to do is talk about, you build that example and then sort of simulate it on your home classical computer or maybe a cloud computer. But you could then send that to run eventually. Maybe you can just describe the process of like how people get involved with trying this stuff out.
Yes, of course. So the Hello World example is performing the Hadamard gate, which is basically the gate that puts a qubit in a superposition, which is the weird thing we talked about where a qubit can be 0, 1 and then a combination of the both. And the tutorial kind of stops just with designing the circuit. Just to clarify, so you have qubits, and then with those qubits, you can perform some instructions on the qubits, which are called quantum gates. And then you put those instructions on a quantum circuit.
Okay.
And then that quantum circuit will be sent to either like a simulator or real quantum hardware. But before it actually, you know, it can be used on a quantum computer, it has to go through translation or compilation, where that high-level code is going to be translated into something that the quantum computer would understand. And then it's going to be sent to the quantum hardware, and then the quantum hardware will have some pulses performed, and then there you have it. Then you actually run the program. So yeah, those are the steps. Yeah.
That's cool. talking about superposition for just a second, this idea of once it's observed, you know, once you look at it, it's mm-hmm. it's going to be in a zero or one state. But what a lot of people were describing it as, or some people have described it as, is like a coin that's spinning. And what I thought was funny is there's a piece of hardware in there, and they their hardware was like called Penny Lane. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, is that based on that idea that they're like coins spinning?
I actually have no idea, but Penny Lane is like a platform and a programming language. Yeah. But that's a good question. I have no idea.
Yeah. I feel like that might be part of it.
Probably.
There.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So to kind of go with that analogy, in superposition, it's like a coin that's just sitting there spinning and spinning and spinning, and you don't know which way it's going to land, per se.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Can we go back to the hardware a little bit?
Uh-huh.
We talked about superconducting circuits and having to cool components to absolute zero. I didn't know about these other ones of like trapped ions.
Yeah, trapped ions are one of the leading, actually, hardware in quantum. And basically, they're individual atoms trapped by electric fields,
okay.
which are controlled by lasers. And they're actually pretty accurate, sometimes more accurate than superconducting ones, but they're very slow. So that's their issues. There's always like a trade-off that comes with this hardware. So there's no like one best hardware that we have.
Okay. So then maybe it's limitations of electricity, again, at superconducted levels versus involving lasers, involving light or something like that. Is that partly maybe what's slowing it down?
Sort of, yeah. Just basically okay. controlling the atoms is sort of harder.
And then the other one was particles of light, photons, mm-hmm. and then looking at the polarization of them.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting about the photonics hardware is that they can be actually used in room temperature.
Okay.
But then the issue is that the photons are really hard to control. Actually, Xanadu is the holder of Penny Lane, and they're using photonics in their hardware.
A few questions here, going back to the summer school. Again, that was IBM's program. Is that right?
Yeah.
Are those recorded? Are those something that you can view later as materials? Or is it more of a thing you have to wait until the next summer rolls around for you to get involved in it?
Well, all of them, all the notebooks are available on their GitHub. And okay. also the lectures that we had in the summer schools are on YouTube, IBM's YouTube. But I highly encourage people to actually attend the summer school because they're going to get a certificate if they finish the labs, which is very valuable.
Okay. As an advocate, what are the things that you're doing? What entails you being an advocate for IBM?
Well, first of all, I'm doing this, so this counts.
Yeah.
Basically, sure. Yeah. So my mission is to make quantum computing more accessible to others while I'm learning myself and sort of just, you know, make it easier to understand. I actually am building my own platform right now, which is called the Path Integral.
Okay.
And I have newsletters and sometimes tutorials where I try to hold your hand while you're learning quantum.
So you're going to have like links for lots of these resources and people can check out. We were talking about this beforehand, that you're in the process of getting all this set up, but by the time this comes out, we should have it all ready to go, and we'll provide links. Lots of items in the show notes this week. I'm sure Nagar is going to provide me here.
Lots of links, yes.
Yeah, because the article is filled with them where people kind of continue their research. I guess, where do you see the next step happening? Like we talked about 6, 7, 8 years ago, like the size of the quantum computers, I think we'll have more sizable versions of them with like maybe approaching 1,000 qubits or more. Each one of these leaps, like how long do you think, if you were to listen to other people in your industry talk about this, what are the predictions?
Yeah, actually, so IBM has a roadmap for when we're going to reach quantum advantage and in general, just having fault tolerance, which it's a fancy word, basically means, so when you run quantum computers, you're going to witness a lot of errors, which are both intrinsic and also they come from the environment of the quantum computer.
Okay.
So when we figure out how to handle these errors while they're compiling, then we get fault tolerance, which is probably a precursor for quantum advantage. So IBM is predicting that we're going to get quantum advantage by 2029.
Okay.
And also we're going to get close to fault tolerance by like 2027-ish. So that's what we're predicting right now.
Okay, yeah. So not too long away here. So the problems that they're having to manage have a little bit to do with the hardware, but also stuff that's inherent with the system as far as getting results that are repeatable. Is that part of it? The whole sort of scientific theory here, we have to have stuff that we can actually run this program and get the results that we want in a repeated way.
Absolutely. Being able to repeat the experiment is essential, but also right now, when you run programs on a quantum computer, you lose the quantumness of the program because of the inherent noise and also the noise that's coming from outside, like the environment.
Okay.
And basically, you don't get results. You lose the information. So that's the main obstacle right now, that we don't have quantum advantage, because we have to tackle these errors somehow. And the technique used is called error mitigation. That's the term. And if you look at quantum echoes or the studies that were done by Vanguard and IBM, they all used error mitigation in order to, even though our hardware is kind of messy right now, we still are able to get some information out of this hardware.
Feels like having a camera that you can't quite get into focus yet, and they're trying to figure out how to kind of do some of that. It's funny because I was talking to somebody about, you know, AI is such a weird term because it's overused. It used to be machine learning, right? And now mm-hmm. It's, you know, everything is all kind of based around LLMs. But there's amazing things happening with photography where this, you know, person I listen to all the time talks about, he has this amazing camera and he bought all these lenses for it. And the problem is usually you're like, ah, man, I got to go buy the new thing because it has a new sensor that works in lower light. But he's been using these advantages of having a machine learning algorithm in, you know, a program like Lightroom, which is from Adobe, that he can take pictures at the highest ISO settings that normally would be just like a noise field, and it can remove all of that. And he's like so excited because he's like, he owns this hardware and being able to like take pictures with it again and get things that he likes about those lenses and be able to make it usable. But it kind of makes me think of a similar thing there where you're like, how do we clean the noise?
Yeah, you just described fault tolerance. Like that's it. That's the same idea. Yeah.
Okay. What are the different directions of high performance computing? Because I hadn't heard that term used. What are the other areas that we kind of think of? I think of, like, again, lots and lots of NVIDIA chips. And I remember, you know, again, going back about 7-8 years, and you know, it's something that's not talked about as much, I feel like. You know, we talk about these massive, quote-unquote, data centers versus what was termed as a supercomputer, and we would measure, like, based around maybe teraflops or something like that, you know, trillions of floating point operations and so forth. But I feel like this is all kind of shifting.
Yeah, actually. So if you look at the current news that's coming out in the quantum realm, you keep hearing that, oh, actually, quantum computers will work best with supercomputers, or as you said, okay, with high performance computing. And high performance computing is basically all the tools and algorithms that you use for parallel computing. So the scheduling, the code that you write, all of that orchestra is called basically HPC or high performance computing. Yeah.
Okay. And most of them are either in large corporations or at universities. I talked to somebody maybe a year and a half ago. He was at the university in Fort Collins here in Colorado, and they would, again, have to schedule time to run their experiments on the different computers. Is that still the technique? Is that something that you're involved with, having to sort of like fractionally look at how you can get your programs running on these machines?
Yeah, exactly. The main bottleneck still is kind of scheduling the clusters so that they actually work in a way that they give us advantage in computing. And yeah, you mentioned NVIDIA, but IBM also has supercomputers, or, you know, HPCs, parallel computers, that you can use with quantum computing. So for example, Qiskit, you can use IBM's supercomputers. And there are other programming languages in quantum where they're integrated with supercomputers. For example, Classic with a Q, they are integrated within the NVIDIA ecosystem of supercomputers, and they're hardware agnostic. And actually, they're one of my favorite programming languages. I think the viewers should check them out.
Okay, cool. Maybe we could do a rundown again of resources where people can continue their own research on this stuff. Are there things that you would suggest as a place to start? I know we said maybe you should have a background, a little bit of background in linear algebra and some of these mathematical techniques, but are there other areas you would say, okay, hey, if you're interested, start here?
Well, first of all, I think just getting kind of maybe reminded or maybe learn about classical computing. So for example, how our gates work, how bits work, just, you know, the basics, so you kind of understand how quantum computing is different fundamentally from that.
Okay.
And you kind of can see the analogous of classical computing and quantum computing. So I recommend starting with classical computing for sure.
Okay. Do you have a resource that you could think of? Or maybe you can share it later. We can put it in the notes. If you're not at a university, you're like kind of doing some of the stuff on your own, you want to learn a little bit about it. Because I feel like understanding how computers work isn't necessarily computer science. I feel like some programs that people have been through, they'll learn like a real basic course on it, and then they would get right into compiling or something else from there. Am I thinking about that right? Again, I didn't finish my university studies, so and they're so long ago.
That's kind of correct, but like in courses like computer architecture, you kind of understand the hardware. Yeah, that's the word. I mean, there are tons of resources about it. I can't think of like a singular one right now.
Okay.
But we can definitely share it in the resources.
Okay, great. All right. So having that background would be good. And then a little bit of the math stuff that we discussed before, the linear algebra, at least if you're not familiar with some of the fundamentals there. Other areas you would suggest?
I think just starting with understanding what's available right now. So if you know Python, then you're already there. Like, for example, we mentioned Qiskit, which is IBM's ecosystem, widely used, has strong error mitigation techniques available. And then we have Circ, which is Google's. You can integrate it with TensorFlow for quantum machine learning. And I mentioned Classic. They have a language called QMod, which also has a Python wrapper.
Okay.
And they're hardware agnostic, so you can write a program and then you can optimize it and then run it on a quantum hardware of your choosing, which is great. Another one is PennyLane, Xanadu's PennyLane, which you mentioned before as well. If you want to go towards the quantum machine learning route, they're also a Python library that you can use. And I also suggest Agora.io. They have events, competitions, discussions, dataset sharing, etc. So I recommend to check them out. Yeah.
It's interesting. It sounds like there's a bunch of resources that are, it's a similar structure to a lot of the data science stuff. If you want to learn that sort of stuff, you'd go to Kaggle and look at data sets potentially, or, you know, again, finding resources out there. So that's great. Because it's a field that's hard to explain and maybe hard to visualize literally, there are skeptics out there, I'm sure, about quantum computing. Are there areas that people are talking about that sort of explain some of these concepts and explain, you know, getting past some of the skepticism that's out there?
Yeah, there are absolutely many skeptics out there. And usually they say, oh, we're getting nowhere. It's going to take us 15 to 20 years to, you know, actually get results, etc. And a lot of researchers are leaving the field. I mean, with the current news, maybe, you know, we're gaining researchers. But before these two main results that we got, a lot of researchers were leaving the field saying, oh, it's just theory. But
okay,
I mean, look at AI now. I mean, you can kind of compare it with that, because back in like 60s till maybe 90s even, we had something called AI winters. And people had this huge expectations that they're going to get very human-like robots back in the 60s especially. And well, they didn't. And even afterwards.
Spoiler alert.
yeah, exactly. And a lot of funds were taken away from research institutes then. And also, again, like they had a breakthrough with specialized robots where they could do like healthcare related things. But then they realized, oh, they don't generalize well. They don't do well with new data. And also, it's just very expensive for them to make them. So they kind of were disappointed again.
Right.
Until now. I mean, everyone is using AI. It's the new bloom. So I think it's helpful to look at quantum in the same way and realize how rapidly it's changing and we're getting new results left and right. So I think there's absolutely hope.
Yeah. It's funny because, I mean, technology has been on such a weird roller coaster of peaks and troughs. And yeah. So that's something that I think any of these technologies face. I'm a little concerned about a potential upcoming, you know, potentially hitting the top peak of things just based around the hype and the things that the way they're marketing it, which I think is kind of a weird thing. And it kind of scares me a little bit about all this stuff sometimes that the people that have the hands on these things are so few, and they're like these, like, you know, large corporations. So I like the idea that some of this is being democratized, at least in this field, where like, okay, hey, we are sharing these resources. And I always think that's a good sign, you know, as far as like it continuing on so that people can learn more about it and continue on. Is that something that you feel also as far as like trying to be an advocate for it generally?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think it's such a interesting field, and also specifically for like if you're in drug design or you're very interested in machine learning or material science, or in general, if your data is big, you have a lot of data and they're correlated, I think you should be prepared. I think, and actually IBM has a term for it, quantum readiness, which is like, hey, quantum is coming. It's not whether it's coming or not. It's coming. So get prepared. And I think right now, like, for example, IBM, Classic, PennyLane, they have all these tutorials and YouTube videos where you can kind of get into the field more easily than before. You don't have to be a physicist anymore or a mathematician anymore, which I think most people should get familiar with the concept of quantum computing.
It feels like the hardware is becoming somewhat more standardized in a way that they can expand it again, going from 4 to 8 to, you know, 100 or more qubits. So that's something that I think also kind of leads to this sort of like, okay, we're on a rise.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as IBM puts it, they need to literally learn new physics to be able to create these hardware. And by time, I mean, we're seeing even with Google's Willow chip, for example, where the quantum echoes was ran on, you can clearly see that we're advancing in this direction.
Yeah. Well, I like to ask people who come on the show a few questions. Okay. And my first question is, what's something that you're excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
My all-time favorite is going to stay as NumPy.
Okay.
But currently, I'm using UV, the packaging and environment manager.
Yeah.
And I love it. I recommend everyone to kind of check it out. Yeah, these two, I think.
Great. Yeah. Things I like to talk about on the show a lot. So what's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about computing. It could be anything you're interested in learning.
Yeah, it is not about quantum, but I would love to learn how to box.
Oh, cool.
So that's next on my list, to learn how to box.
There was such a phase, oh gosh, maybe 90s, early 2000s, of kickboxing and as like a workout kind of thing. Is it for that, or is it for other reasons?
Well, I love working out, and in general, I think it just seems very interesting. I mean, you will be hitting stuff, and also it's an exercise. So I think it's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Get your frustrations out in one way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
We spoke about the site that you're building. Is that going to be the best way to follow your work online?
That, and on LinkedIn, I always talk about the things that I'm working on, the updates that I have about my current project, etc. So I think LinkedIn also is a good way to reach me.
All right. We'll definitely include links for that.
Thank you.
Nagar, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was really fantastic to talk to you.
Same here. I had so much fun. Thank you for having me.
I want to thank Nagar for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.